Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. The Lakeside Planning Group will hold a hearing on Thursday when it's expected to vote on a sand mining proposal that is one of the most contentious land use projects the community has ever faced. Next up, we'll have a recap on the first Santee City Council candidate forum, where all seven candidates participated. Our newsmaker interview today is with Chardet Fontenot, a candidate running on a reform slate with two other candidates for the La Mesa Spring Valley School District Board. Hear why they're calling for change on the school board, including seeking more respect for minority students, parents, and teachers. Plus, hear about some deceptive tactics being used by their opponents, a conservative slate of candidates also vying to control the board. On the second half of our show today, we'll have a Halloween treat for you as we replay some East County ghost stories in one of our classic Best of East County episodes. And finally, learn how you can help some local Boy Scouts in need after thieves stole two trailers full of their supplies, including all the gear needed to run their annual fundraiser, a Christmas tree lot in El Cajon. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. The Lakeside Community Planning Group will hold a public hearing this Thursday on an environmental impact report on a controversial sand mining project proposed in the El Monte Valley. After public comments and discussion, planning group members are expected to vote on the project's EIR. The meeting will be held at the Lakeside Community Center starting at 6 p.m. Thursday. The vote is advisory only. The next step will be a hearing before the County Planning Commission, and ultimately, supervisors are expected to have the final say. The project has generated widespread opposition. About 500 Lakeside residents turned out at a recent meeting held by county planners, and all opposed the sand mining project proposed by El Monte Nature Preserve, LLC, the deceptively named mining company. The project would generate trucks all day long, every several seconds, 6 days a week over the next dozen years from dredging along the San Diego riverbed near homes and wildlife habitat. Key concerns among residents include noise, traffic, dust, and exposure to potentially deadly valley fever spores found in the valley soil. The project would also negatively impact riding trails and equestrian-based businesses, as well as habitat for many threatened and endangered species found in El Monte Valley. The developer contends his project is needed to provide sand for construction of roadways in San Diego County and says the land would be restored in about 15 years after the sand mining is completed. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
In April, the City of Santee ended its at-large election system by adopting an ordinance that divided the city into four election districts. The electoral battle on November 6th now has seven candidates from three districts. Registered to run in District 1 are Evelyn Andrade Hamesfield and current Vice Mayor Rob McNellis. In District 2, Councilmember Ron Hall and Rudy Reyes. In District 3, Zach Giannino, Laura Koval, and Linda Maricao. On October 4th, all candidates participated in a public forum organized by the Santee Chamber of Commerce and answered questions from voters on economic growth, traffic issues, marijuana, and more. All candidates started with an opening statement mentioning their backgrounds and what connects them to Santee. Linda Maricao has lived in Santee for 61 years and served on the Santee Redevelopment Project Area Committee. She says her mother was involved in Santee's incorporation as a city, which taught her the importance of serving the community. Maricao is endorsed by the Democratic Party and has the slogan, "Citizen, not politician." Zach Giannino is the youngest candidate at age 25. He says he moved to Santee in 2005 and has worked in a state assembly office. His philosophy is think globally, act locally. He has degrees in political science and international relationships from UCSD. He says there's a disconnect between the community and the city council while Santee transitions from a small town to a big city, a cultural change that requires a new type of leadership with greater transparency, such as holding more town halls and live streaming city council meetings. Evelyn Andrade Himsfield was born in Southern California and became a Santee resident this year while looking for a safe community to raise her family. She wants innovative ideas to solve the city's current problems and brings in management experience as a software engineer and business owner. "I want to stand for what's important to you and bring change to our community," she says, adding that she wants to be a voice for the people, not corporate and development interests that control the council. Vice Mayor Rob McNellis has served on the city council since 2010 and said that prior to running, he started showing up at council budget meetings and learned that there wasn't enough money to fix things he was upset about. He said he was also upset that law enforcement didn't know the community very well and wants Santee to have its own police department instead of contracting with the sheriff. Councilman Ron Hall, a former Chamber of Commerce president, says he's married to Santee, having lived here and run an insurance business in the city for over 2 decades. Hall said he is always active on Facebook and available to answer the phone because that's what you do, help people, you answer questions, it's your job. Rudy Reyes is a Cedar Fire survivor from Verona who wants to give back to his community. Reyes says, "The real reason why I run in this election is that you have a problem with the council not listening to the voice of the people." He said he has worked on environmental causes and taken stances against SDG&E. Laura Koval grew up in Lakeside and lived in Santee for the past 26 years, graduating from San Diego State University. Her first full-time job was with the Boys and Girls Club of East County. She is now Director of Parks and Recreation at Santee Lakes and serves on the Chamber of Commerce Board. Koval says, "I run because I looked at the budget, financials, and I'm very concerned." Koval says, "I run because I looked at the budget financials and I'm very concerned. I actually have the experience to fix the budget." Next came questions for the candidates, including their views on new businesses coming to Santee, such as Carl Strauss Brewery, a movie theater, a 4-star hotel, and a full-service grocery store. All voiced support for some or all of these projects. Hall says he's worked hard to bring a movie theater slated to open next month in Santee. Koval notes that bringing businesses to Santee helps resolve the traffic issue by bringing jobs to the community to reduce commuting. Maracal says infrastructure needs to be improved to ease traffic before bringing in major new businesses. Reyes agrees that jobs are needed, but adds, "The issue is how we bring them in, how to build the transit. We need to build the streets and the lights. If we bring a hotel, we really need a nice convention center that will bring the real money." Asked about bringing manufacturing jobs to Santee, Hall says Santee does not have enough space. Maracal raises traffic concerns. Andrade Himsfield notes that manufacturing jobs are leaving the U.S., adding, "Tech is our new industry." Andrade Himsfield says, "We have the highest educated people in the country," and proposes working with businesses to bring the jobs to Santee to reduce the number of commuters and increase revenues for the city. Traffic gridlock has become a major concern in Santee, especially on Highway 52, after construction of major new housing projects and more in the pipeline. Asked how to resolve this problem, Hall says he created Coalition 52 with other cities, adding, "We can't wait for Sandag to get their act together. He wants to get Caltrans and the rest of the cities in East County together and find a solution." Koval says she commuted for a long time and understands the traffic problem firsthand. For her, the solution is to bring jobs to East County to change the traffic flow. Reyes urges people to send letters to Sandag because every voice counts. They have a list of projects and R-52 is not set to be completed until 2050. Maracal states, "We can't stop development, but we can develop smart." Andrade Himsfield is opposed to the 3,000 units at Finita Ranch project. She says, "I think adding at least 6,000 cars on the road every single day would absolutely make the problem worse." She wants to sink all lights on Mass Boulevard to help ease traffic congestion. Giannino says Santee doesn't need rapid development that can't keep up with the infrastructure. How can we prevent Santee from becoming Los Angeles? He asks, then adds, "We need to follow the general plan," referring to a ballot measure that would give Santee residents a vote on any proposed project requiring waivers of the general plan. The current city council majority, including Hall and McNellis, voted to study that proposal instead of putting it on the November ballot. Asked how to bring revenues to Santee, Koval says she redesigned the pricing scale at Santee Lakes that brought in millions of dollars and helped increase the revenue for the city through a transient occupancy tax in consensus with McNellis. Maracal says the city needs growth, but faces a bad situation with the budget and needs someone to get the bull by the horns. Andrade Himesfield called for thinking outside the box to find solutions. She said she would bring some competition in town to Cox Cable to generate millions of dollars in revenue by building a high-speed gigabyte internet owned by the city. Reyes pushed for a convention center and for reinvesting in Santee by upgrading the industrial zone to attract giants. Permitting for marijuana dispensaries was another hot topic, the younger candidates Giannino, Andrade Himesfield, and Reyes being favorable to creating local revenue from local dispensaries. Currently, Santee does not allow any marijuana sales. All candidates ended the forum by sharing their vision for the city and their hopes to see their visions materialize in the near future. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Goetz.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Today, my very special guest is Chardé Fontenot. She's a candidate running for the La Mesa Spring Valley School District Board on a slate of three candidates seeking to bring changes to the district. The others on her slate are Rebecca McCray, a teacher, and Jerry Lecco, an architect and former school board member. The district has three conservative board members who are not seeking re-election, so with three open seats, there's an opportunity to shift the balance of power on this board. Now, the slate represents a grassroots group that was actually started by teachers and students, and it's called the La Mesa Spring Valley Action Committee for Educators and Students, or ACES for short. Chardé is a mother of two sons in the Casa de Oro Elementary School. She says she's the only candidate who was once a student in this district herself, and now she's a certified lactation educator and counselor who also owns a small business in lactation. She's served in the La Mesa Spring Valley District as a parent volunteer and a district advisory council representative, and now she chairs a school site council. Chardé, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you start by telling us why you're running for the school board?
I'm running for the school board because I think there needs to be a change. I think that it's been the same voices for far too long, and I think that we really need to bring some fresh, informed, unique voices to the school board. I feel that there's been a lack of transparency, and there needs to be more innovative ideas that are being brought to the table, and there needs to be more of a show of support for our students and our community.
What do you believe are the most important issues in this race, and where do you stand on them?
I think some of the important issues are our funding and our enrollment in terms of the district. I think that we need to be innovative in the ways that we find to increase our funding. We need to find more external streams of revenue that is steady, and we also need to look into ways that we can bring more families into our school district and have them going to our schools. I think that we're on the right path, but I would like to see it excel. Also, some of the issues that I think that the board has is that they have, like I said, have a lack of respect, and the community did bring forth something that they were concerned about, which was the taking away of sixth grade camp, and that was about 9 years ago, and so we have not had sixth grade camp, which is a rite of passage for many students.
Yeah, I certainly remember going through that district myself back in the dark ages. We won't say how many years ago, but I had very warm memories of sixth grade camp, and it's sad that the kids today aren't getting that experience.
Right. So I think that we can find ways to bring it back while being fiscally responsible. We can look into grants, we can look into partnerships, fundraising, but we definitely need to look into bringing it back, especially with, you know, the technology that the kids are using. I think sixth grade camp is a great way for them to get out and learn how to do things on their own and be more independent.
Definitely. What else do you hope to accomplish if you're elected?
I hope to accomplish closing the achievement gap. I think that it's been open for a little while, and I think that we're on the right track in terms of closing it, but I would like to see that process be sped up.
Now, according to the state test scores, which we did look up, 50% of the students in the La Mesa Spring Valley School District have tested to have proficiency in English, and only 39% have proficiency in math. According to the site niche.com that ranks schools statewide based on key data, this district gets a C grade on academics. So what can or should be done to raise those test scores?
I think it's going to take some time. The Common Core curriculum was implemented just a few years ago, so the kids are still getting used to it and how it's done. It is pretty difficult. I've seen my child's homework. And I think that we need to talk with our teachers more about ways that we can help them to do better. But I think that the teachers, for the most part, are working very hard on it and doing a good job. I think it's just going to take some time for the kids to get used to it.
The district rates an A on diversity of student population. Do you believe the needs of diverse students are being met adequately?
I do not feel like the needs of our diverse students are being met. I feel that the achievement gap is the largest between our white and our minority students. The tests are being administered on iPads, and not all schools are on a one-to-one ratio with their iPads. So some of those kids may not be technically proficient in using the iPads when it comes to the test, and that could be affecting that as well.
Sure, and I'll bet a lot of the poorer kids don't have an iPad at home, whereas probably the wealthier ones do. So it's also a wealth gap issue.
Right.
What can be done to provide equal access to iPads and training on it for all students?
I think that we can reach out to our community a little bit more, and we can look into partnering with them to get more iPads if the school site itself is not going to provide one-to-one ratio. For the test, I believe that they do work it out to where they all have their iPads individually at the same time to work on it, but just using it throughout the year so that they're familiar with it. So when test time comes, they know how to use it. And there were a lot of technical difficulties at the beginning stages of doing that test on the iPad. So it's something that we need to look into helping the kids with.
A recent controversy in this district involved a board member, David Chong, who is stepping down. He's moving out of the area. He's a gun store owner, and he drew criticism for his remarks that ridiculed students voicing concerns over gun violence after a mass school shooting in Florida. What do you believe are the best ways to protect students' safety?
I think that the best way to protect our students' safety is to be proactive and not reactive. I think we need to look into getting counselors in all of our schools. Not all of our schools have counselors. We have a counselor at my children's school. She's only there 3 days a week, but she's awesome. And I think that if we can implement that more, even if it's starting off with just once a week at the schools, that would be a great way to be proactive and taking a step towards safety.
What about arming teachers, as we've heard some people call for?
I do not agree with arming teachers. I do not think that's a viable solution to protecting our kids, to making them feel safe. I think that guns in the classroom is not going to help prevent the school shootings, and I don't think it's going to help our kids or our teachers or our parents feel safe about having their children at that school.
You mentioned to me you've talked to a lot of teachers about this. What did they say?
They're not on board with being armed. Armed with highlighters and markers. Pencils.
But not guns. Okay. Yeah. Do you think board members should show respect for everybody who comes to speak to the board, regardless of your own personal views on issues such as the gun violence or anything else?
Yes, I definitely think there needs to always be a high level of respect for our community members, our parents, and our students from the board. I feel that there has been a huge lack of respect from our board. I've been to the board meetings and I don't feel that they are very respectful when it comes to talking with the public.
You know, another example of that, where a lot of people in the community felt they weren't respectful of the majority, was when the board decided to fill a vacancy by appointing a church secretary with basically no experience in education who had just moved to the district. And they chose her over more qualified candidates, including a former teachers union president and another candidate who was a PTA president who'd served on the district's bond oversight committee. Would you pledge, if a vacancy were to occur again, to put qualifications and experience over partisanship in filling future vacancies?
I definitely would put qualifications and experience over partisanship. When it comes to filling a vacancy, that is the most important thing, is their experience and their empathy for our children and the community. And I was very disappointed with the appointment process that happened, that board did when that happened. It was just very devastating because the people that were up against that particular person were well qualified, and you know, I think they could have made a better choice.
Yeah. I mean, we should mention this is a district that's had a history of these types of issues. Mm-hmm. Some years ago, I remember they made a decision not to run Obama's speech to children in the schools. Traditionally in the past, every president, whether they were a Republican or a Democrat, would write a speech, you know, to be heard by students, and all of the schools would run it. And they didn't. And that caused quite an outcry. There were hundreds of people who turned up to protest that. I think one of the board members apologized. Of course, not all the same board members are on there, but it's sort of the same conservative block that's controlled the board for a very long time.
Right. I definitely think that along with that appointment process, it was very political, especially seeing that the other candidates were well qualified with the person that was appointed was not qualified. I think that that was a political decision, and that should not play a part in our school board or the decisions that are being made for our kids. It should not be about partisanship. Politics needs to stay out of the school board.
Yeah. Religion is another issue that's come up, whether there may be some religious views influencing decisions, perhaps, of some board members. You've mentioned to me that you had concerns about how the sex education program is being implemented in the district. Can you elaborate?
Yes, I think that there just needs to be more inclusion for our LGBT students and families. I feel that after talking with some teachers about the current family life curriculum, it is not up to date and it is not inclusive of our LGBT families, and that's very disheartening.
What about abstinence only?
I believe that they teach abstinence. I'm not sure if it's abstinence only, but I do think we need to provide our students with all of the options. When we're talking about sex ed, they need to be prepared in going to the real world. They need to know what everything is about when we talk about family life, and not just that a man and a woman get married and they have a baby. And
yeah, we know statistically that while it might sound like a great idea, that it really hasn't worked in other states or nationwide. Statistically, there's more teen pregnancies and STDs and things like that in districts that teach abstinence only than in those that don't.
Yes, and we shouldn't be encouraging the students to have sex.
Right.
It's more about just making them aware of sex in the real world and what the different issues are and what the different options are, and just letting males and females know that they have different choices when they get to that point in their life. And hopefully that is much later in life.
Right. And what the consequences are of those choices. Okay. Who are your major endorsements for yourself as well as your slate, Sade?
My major endorsements include for my slate, the La Mesa Spring Valley Teachers Association, as well as the California School Employees Association. That's for me, Rebecca McCray, and Jerry Lecco. For Rebecca McCray and myself, we have been endorsed by Run Women Run, as well as the Heartland Firefighters of La Mesa, Local 4759. Rebecca and I have both been endorsed by the Democratic Party of San Diego as well.
Right. And we should add, it is a multi-party slate because Jerry Lecco, the third person on there, is an independent who, in fact, is a former Republican that formerly served on this board. Now, there are three other candidates running on a slate of their own. It's a conservative slate backed by the Republican Party. And in all fairness, they are Pastor Steve Babbitt, Megan Epperson, and Brianna Garza. There is also a seventh candidate in the race, Matthew Sablov, who's running on his own and isn't backed by any slate. And we haven't really been able to find a lot of evidence that he's been campaigning. I haven't seen a website. He did not show up at a recent candidate forum. Nor, for that matter, did two of the conservatives. Pastor Babbitt did show up and gave us and shared his views. We would certainly welcome a representative from the opposing slate to come on and join us on the show, as well as the unaffiliated candidate if he wishes to be heard. There's been some controversy over tactics that some might call deceptive being used by the other slate of candidates. Sade, would you like to address those?
Yes. It's just been very misleading that the opposite slate, the opponents, have used a stock photo of a woman that is not on their slate, and they are passing it off as a member of their slate, which is a Hispanic woman, and the stock photo is of a Hispanic woman that looks to be a teacher. They also have been posting that they are teacher-supported, and we are the only three that are endorsed by the Teachers Association.
Wow.
However, they've been misleading people that they're supported by the teachers, which some people might believe means endorsed by the teachers.
No, they're talking about maybe some individual teachers, but not the teachers organization. The running a photo of somebody that's not a candidate and passing it off as if it is really deceptive. I've never heard of anybody doing that before. What did they say when that issue was raised?
Some people reached out to one of the Slate members, and he basically said it is a stock photo. He admitted to that and did not seem to have any issue with having that as the representative for their Slate, the face for their Slate.
And this was a young, attractive-looking Hispanic woman. Yeah. There is a Hispanic woman on their Slate, but I don't know what she looks like. I haven't found a photo of her anywhere.
Right. So no one really knows much about that candidate, the Hispanic woman on their Slate. And so it seems as though they are using the photo for optics reasons of an attractive Hispanic woman that appears to be a teacher and putting that on their, you know, information that they're putting out for their campaign materials.
Another thing we've seen over and over in this district on the conservative side of the aisle has been some deception in terms of who people really are. For example, last time there was a gun owner who ran, called himself a teacher, and in fact, what he taught was firearm safety classes. He didn't teach in any public school or even any private or charter school. This time around, we have Mr. Babbitt, Pastor Babbitt, who lists himself as a businessman on the ballot statement and doesn't mention that he is a pastor of a church in Spring Valley, which, you know, some people may like that, but certainly it seems like with the controversies that we've seen in this district over religious concerns perhaps making their way into some of the decisions, that seems like it's a fact that voters should have. It shouldn't be something that's, you know, hidden.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And, you know, I'm not against religion in any way, shape, or form. However, I don't think that religion needs to be on the agenda in terms of who we're electing for our school board to represent our community. Everyone has a different religion. In our school district specifically, it is very diverse in terms of religion, and we are seeing a lot of kids come from all over the world now, and we really need to just be respectful that everyone has a different religion and not have it solely focused on one religion when we're talking about our school board and making the decisions for our children.
The opposing Slate has also engaged in some fear-mongering, claiming that your Slate, Chardé, wants to shut down the Peter Pan Junior Theater program in the schools. Can you comment on that, please?
Yes, I thought that that was a very disgraceful tactic that they used. I myself have been involved in the performing arts since I was 4 years old. I was a ballet dancer, modern and jazz dance for some many, many years. And so I definitely support the arts. I know that my Slate mates as well have no issue with the arts themselves. Nothing against the performing arts and the theater. Both of our children, Rebecca McCray and I's children, have been to Peter Pan Jr. Theater performances. And Jerry Lecco has been to quite a few himself. So we definitely have, you know, nothing against the Peter Pan Jr. Theater. I wish that it would be promoted a little bit more throughout our district.
Because, so you're not trying to shut it down?
No, we're definitely not interested in shutting it down. And actually, the school board has no authority over that program. I believe it's a nonprofit organization that is run solely on its own outside of the district. It is not a district-sponsored program, so we have no authority over whether it stays open or not.
Well, thank you very much for setting the record straight on that.
You're welcome.
Listeners, if you just tuned in, we are speaking with Chardé Fontenot, one of the candidates running for the Mesa Spring Valley School District Board, along with a Slate that's backed by La Mesa Spring Valley Action Community for Educators and Students, a group that was founded by teachers and students in the district. Where can people find out more about that?
They can find out more about that on LaMesaSpringValleyAces.org.
Thank you very much, LaMesaSpringValleyAces.org. Chardé, I'm going to give you the final word today. What else would you like our listeners to know about you and the other candidates on your slate for the La Mesa Spring Valley School District Board?
I encourage everyone to visit that website, and from there you'll be able to find all of our websites individually, Jerry Lecco, Rebecca McCray, and myself, and just find out that we are the most qualified, well-rounded slate in this race. We are also the only three candidates in this race that have been endorsed by the La Mesa Spring Valley Teachers Association, as well as the California School Employees Association. And we are truly about children, community, and commitment.
Very good. I want to thank you very much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, the network for social justice.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, broadcasting from the mountains to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. We have a special treat for you today for Halloween, some local East County ghost stories. East County has many reportedly haunted places. There are many stories of ghost soldiers haunting the former Army barracks in Campo, the final home of the famed Buffalo Soldiers Cavalry Brigade. The old Julian Hotel's original proprietor from the 1800s reportedly haunts the establishment, startling guests in his former room who have claimed he's even tried to climb into bed with them. Out at the old Vallecito stagecoach station, the ghost of a bride who never made it to the altar and died along the trail reportedly roams the premises searching for her lost love, clad in the wedding gown in which she was buried. And out along Lakeside's Wildcat Canyon Road, if you see a woman beckoning to you to follow her off the road, don't go. Witnesses have claimed she turns toward her victims to reveal no face at all, a dark specter intent on luring motorists off an embankment to their deaths on a roadway where many people have died. But the most spirited area in our region is the Anza Borrego Desert, according to many detailed stories of ghosts that reportedly haunt those lonely trails, mountains, and washes in that harsh, forbidding terrain. Storyteller Cactus Jim has written, "Many travelers, prospectors, and adventurers have gone into the desert never to return or be seen again. Others have returned with gold nuggets and treasures so rare that we could only dream of being so lucky ourselves. Desert lore, stories, and quests for loot and gold have made men greedy. Gunfights, murders, and death from starvation have left many dead on the barren desert trails. Their ghosts still walk the mountain ridges, gullies, and deserted locations they once traveled or lived, spirits with unfinished business who cannot rest. Some guard buried treasures and lost mines, while others battle perpetually until death, forever replaying their last moments of life," Cactus Jim wrote. So here are a few of the most haunting tales in that region, adapted from Desert USA and the Paranormal Blogspot.
In the 1860s, when stagecoaches were the primary means of cross-country travel, a special stage set out from El Paso, headed for San Diego, with a box of coins. The stage that carried the coins had one driver and a guard. When the stage reached Yuma, Arizona, the guard fell ill and the driver continued on without him. That same stage was held up by robbers somewhere in the area where the route meanders into Carrizo Wash in East County's desert region, between the Fish and the Coyote Mountains. The driver was shot during the robbery and the thieves stashed the coins in the south slope of Fish Mountain. The coins remain there to this day, they say, because there were too many soldiers passing by on the trail for the bandits to retrieve their loot. It is said that after the robbery, the dead driver and the stage continued through Carrizo, and after that, the stage disappeared, never to be seen again, at least not in an earthly form. But some witnesses say that the phantom stage still forges its way through the deep sand, pulled by a team of four mules on moonlit nights. The phantom stage is driven by a lone driver hunched over as if asleep. No passengers are seen on the stage when it passes through Carrizo Wash, hesitating only a moment, as if planning to stop where the Carrizo station once stood, though it's now only a pile of mud. The phantom stage continues on past the old station until out of sight. In the morning, you may think twice about whether you actually saw the phantom stage until you find ruts carved from wagon wheels and fresh hoof prints left behind by the ghostly stage that travels on occasion as if to keep the trail alive.
Vallecito is known for its ghost. Its history contains many murders, deaths, robberies, and other wicked tales. One well-known story involves a double murder at Vallecito Station. It all started with a stage holdup in which $65,000 worth of loot was stolen by four men on horseback who robbed the eastbound stage before reached Carrizo Wash en route to Vallecito Station. As the men fled the scene, the driver of the stage fired one shot, killing one of the four men. When he reached the thief he had shot, he found not one, but two dead bodies. The driver concluded that the leader of the band of thieves had shot one of his own men, so he would not have to divide up the loot. The bandit leader and one of the thief survived the robbery and buried their loot in nearby hills, then rode on to Vallecito Station for a drink and some food. But the two bandits began to argue while having a drink. The leader of the outlaws went outside to check on his horse, promising to continue the discussion when he returned. He did return, entering through the doorway, mounted on his big white horse, and he shot his companion. As the wounded bandit was dying, he drew his gun and fired back at the leader, killing him off the back of his brave white horse. The white stallion, spooked by the gunfire and death of his master, ran off into the hills. It is said that when someone is in the valley, around midnight, near where the bandits buried their loot, the ghost of a white horse will appear from nowhere, galloping through the sand and then disappearing without a trace.
If you find yourself out late in the desert night, somewhere between the Superstition Mountains and the 17 Palms, you may see the apparition of an 8-foot glowing skeleton. Prospector by the name of Charlie Arizona first saw the ghost about 4 miles southeast of Borrego. It was a dark night when Charlie set up for camp. Just as he was settling down for the night, something disturbed his burrows. Hearing their frightened braying, he went to investigate. A shadow loomed large. Suddenly, he saw a large human skeleton with a lantern light shining right through its ribs. The skeleton walked in a crazy fashion, as if looking for something or as if it were lost. Heart pounded, Charlie watched, transfixed as the skeleton disappeared over the ridge. About 2 years later, two prospectors camping in Superstition Mountains caught sight of the flickering light in the distance and wondered what it was, but it quickly disappeared. One of the prospectors thought it looked like a skeleton carrying a lantern, but they figured it was just the fire reflecting off a rock. The two prospectors didn't think much of the incident until a year later, when a traveler came into the Vallecito station with the tail of a skeleton he saw wandering in the desert carrying a light. It wasn't long before the news of the skeleton got around, and two adventurers went out into the desert to search for this legendary skeleton ghost. During their third night in the desert, they encountered the ghastly lit skeleton. One of the men shot at it with a gun, but the skeleton continued on, unfazed by the gunfire. The two men followed the skeleton for 3 miles as it wandered in a strange and intermittent gait, over ridges and through valleys, before they lost track of it. Many believe that the skeleton is the ghost of a prospector who discovered and worked the Phantom Mine, which has been lost for many years. The skeleton is no better off than the rest of us, for he continues to search for the lost Phantom Mine, wandering the dark desert nights looking for his final resting place.
Not far from the Phantom Mine lies another place where skeletons have been seen. During warm summer nights, when the moon is full, ghosts dance at Yaqui Well. The ghosts are said to be the spirits of three emigrants who were traveling from Yuma to California. In search of a shorter route through the desert, the emigrants arrived at Yaqui Well, exhausted and near death from lack of food and water. One of the three travelers drank from the well as much water as he could hold. He died shortly thereafter. The other two men also drank from the well, but survived. While moving their dead companion's body, the other two noticed some rock specimens that fell out of his pocket. The two men were excited to discover the rocks contained gold, but they did not know where their friend had found the samples. Their excitement about the gold turned into greed and distrust. The two men began to struggle until one finally drowned the other in the muddy water of Yaqui Well. An Indian watched these events unfold from a nearby hill. He tried to talk to the man who had survived, but the immigrant was still so excited as he told his story that he entered a state of frenzy and ran off into the desert yelling, "Gold! Gold!" It is only during the hot summer nights of the full moon that the three emigrants return to Yaqui Well. One rises out of the muddy waters of the Yaqui Well, one emerges from the brush nearby, and the third arrives in the cool breeze out of the wash. The ghosts join hands and circle Yaqui Well in a dance. Soon after the twirling begins, they disappear, leaving only the good waters of the well and a slight chill in the air.
In the 1800s, many stories began circulating about a ship lying half buried in the sands of the Anza Borrego Desert, and some say its spectral sails unfurl at times on a ghostly voyage, its phantom crew seeking their way back home. After the Civil War, many migrants who passed through the desert on their way to California reported seeing a Spanish galleon with multiple masts and swore this was no mirage. Most claimed that it was loaded with a fortune's worth of exquisite pearls. Many expeditions sought to retrieve these riches, but so far, none have succeeded. As the story goes, in 1610, King Philip III of Spain ordered Alvarez de Cordone to search off Mexico's coast and bring back pearls. Cordone hired two other captains, Juan de Iturbe and Pedro de Rosales. He also hired 60 pearl divers and had three ships built. In 1612, they set sail to plunder Mexico's west coast of its precious oysters. The ship paused repeatedly in its travels so that pearl divers could jump off and return with oysters they discovered on the ocean floor. Later, they found a village where Native Americans had baskets of pearls just lying about. The Spaniards arranged a trade of their fancy European clothing for the pearls, but instead swindled the Native Americans by giving them only rags and dirty cloths. Outraged, the Indians attacked the ship as it was trying to set sail. Cordone was hit by an arrow, and his ship was forced to turn around. But he ordered the other two ships on in the search of more pearls, commanding them to look north in the Gulf of California. As they journeyed up the Gulf, Rosales' ship struck a reef in a terrible storm. Before it sank, the crew transferred the valuable cargo to Iturbe's vessel, which sailed up the Gulf and eventually up the Colorado River and into the Salton Sea, or Lake Cahuilla, as it may have been called long ago. Some stories claim that the ship sailed into the Salton Sea to find the legendary Straits of Anian, an all-water route from the Gulf of California to the Gulf of Mexico. It's been said that the Salton Sea and the Colorado River ran high, filled with water during a flood that swept the ship into the vast inland sea. Some say that an earthquake happened, closing off escape. The captain was horrified to find the outlet to the ocean blocked. Water in the lake was swiftly evaporating. Soon the ship was beached on the California desert, many miles from the sea. The crew grabbed what few supplies they could carry and abandoned ship, trudging westwards toward the water. As the story goes, the survivors were finally picked up. Other versions of the tale involve a pirate ship loaded down with almost a million doubloons. Another story states that the ship was from King Solomon's Navy, carrying the 10 lost tribes of Israel to North America. Another variation on this story claims that the Cahuilla Indians, knowing the Spanish were coming to take their riches and harm them, ambushed the Spanish party that came ashore. Then the tribe mounted a full attack on the galleon and after a fierce battle annihilated the entire crew. The Cahuillas began looting the ship of food and exotic items, but they could not move nor break into the heavy large iron chests in the hold. Then a storm brewed up, dousing the galleon. The Native Americans were forced to desert the ship, which broke from its anchor, drifted off into the storm, and sunk into the inland sea, taking its precious cargo with it. By the time the lake dried up years later, the ship had been long buried under tons of dirt, sand, and silt. How true could these stories be? Lake Cahuilla did exist in the 16th century and had a tribe of Native Americans living nearby. It is possible that a flood occurred connecting the Salton Sea to the Gulf of California. The area between the desert and the Gulf has the potential to be hit with massive flooding, as we know from Hurricane Kathleen in the 1970s, which sent a 10-foot-high wall of water across the desert floor. So yes, it is plausible a ship could have been carried in on the surge and stranded afterwards as water receded. The sheer number of stories told by both Native Americans and frontiersmen through the centuries suggests some truth to these lost ship tales. Expeditions in search of the lost treasure ship began in the 1800s after travelers heard tales from Native Americans. Some claimed that the ship seen in the desert was haunted and could only be found at certain times of the year. In 1870, several Indians reported seeing the ship west of Dos Palmas. Later that year, the Los Angeles Star published a series of short stories about Charlie Klusker, who claimed to have located the ship and its broken masts. He was organizing expeditions to bring back the missing vessel, which he claimed was filled with crosses. It was reportedly 50 miles from Dos Palmas in a region of boiling mud springs. But there were no further updates, and Mr. Klusker appears to have simply disappeared, much like the elusive ship. In 1878, three German prospectors said they saw the ship around sundown, about 120 miles northwest of Yuma and 40 miles east of Indio. The sighting actually cost one of the prospectors their lives. The two survivors reported seeing an immense ship under full sail floating over the desert, sailing like a cloud into the sunset. The prospector who died went after it in the next morning, but never returned. A rescue party eventually found him dead from a lack of water, and strangely, he was completely nude. In 1905, a prospector named Butcherknife Ike claimed to have discovered a fossil ship buried in the sand dunes of Borrego Springs. And in 1915, a Yuma Indian arrived in one town paying for his merchandise with pearls. When questioned, he claimed to have spent the night in a strangely shaped wooden house that was partially covered by sand. The people he spoke to offered him several hundreds of dollars for the night if he would take them back there in the morning, but he vanished overnight with their money. In 1933, Antonio de Fierro Blanco wrote a book discussing the story of Tiburcio Mancera, a young mule driver who claimed he came across the lost Spanish galleon way back in 1775. Back then, Tiburcio was a mule driver for explorer Juan Bautista de Anza, who was searching for a land route from Sonora to Alta California. The young mule driver said he went into the hold of the ship and actually saw a treasure trove of pearls, but was never able to relocate the evasive ship. Many treasure hunters have gone after the missing treasure of pearls, but none have brought back evidence of finding it, perhaps because these are simply tall tales, or perhaps because the shifting sands of the desert at times reveal and at other times obscure the legendary lost ship. According to some storytellers, the ship itself, now bleached white and desiccated by the whipping sands, blown by the desert winds, has become a ghost. If you're out in the desert late some night, you may just see an eerie, otherworldly glow and hear the singing of those long-dead sailors, the skeleton of a ghost ship sailing into the sunset or adrift in the moonlight. Is the mysterious ship laden with the fortune and pearls still out there in the desert? Perhaps sailing spectrally over the sands? Perhaps one day, when the sands blow the right way, we'll be lucky enough to find out.
Now we have one last hair-raising tale to tell, and this one is about the mysterious giant black cats reported to be prowling the wilds of East County. A reader tells us that sightings of huge black cats the size of mountain lions or bigger date back at least to the 1980s, when witnesses described a black cougar near Highway 67 at the eastern end of Poway. Zoology experts claim there is no such thing as a black cougar or mountain lion, though they once said the same thing about black bobcats, until one was killed by a car and proof positive was found that these once legendary animals existed. Another possibility is a black leopard, an exotic pet that's escaped. But a more likely explanation for the many sightings here is that there are black jaguars in northern Mexico, big cats that when fully grown can be much larger than mountain lions. An adult male can weigh up to 350 pounds, though females can be about the size of mountain lions and cubs even smaller. Jaguars have golden eyes, squared heads, and very powerful jaws capable of taking down a full-sized crocodile in the wild. Officially, jaguars have been extinct in California for decades. But have they returned? Or perhaps they never really left. Yet another possibility is that jaguars have bred with mountain lions. That, too, is thought to be impossible, scientists say, but they once thought wolves could not breed with coyotes, until DNA testing proved that they did, and frequently. Many of the early sightings in San Diego County of large black wildcats have been made close to the border, some very near a gap in the border fence in Hukumba Hot Springs, where the terrain was too rugged to connect the fence up. Howard Cook, the former head of Hukumba's planning group, told me there have been regular sightings in recent years of a big black cat believed to be a jaguar, and also what appears to be a golden black spotted jaguar at Lake Hukumba. Such a pair could give birth to cubs that could be either black or spotted.
He believes the big cats crossed over from Mexico, and the town librarian's son also saw what he described as a black panther crossing Old Highway 80 and Boulevard some years ago, though there's technically no such thing as a black panther either, a term used by ordinary folks to describe any of several big black cats. Gene Garrity told us that he and a friend, both farm boys, were out hunting above Loveland Reservoir south of Alpine back in 1994 when a huge black cat crossed the road in front of them. The tail was very fat and very long, he said. We got out of my Jeep, and we were looking at the paw prints in the mud. They were huge, with very huge claw marks. I estimate the cat was close to 200 pounds or more, he said. Assistant Border Patrol Chief Rosario Pete Vasquez told me, I saw one on Mount Laguna maybe 20 years ago. It was daytime, and there was snow on the ground, so you could definitely tell it was all black. That big cat weighed about 100 pounds, he estimated. One winter night in 2011, the Reader reported that a resident of Hapatool Valley south of Alpine, Warren Storm Thunder, claimed he saw a jaguarundi, a black cat from central Mexico that is a little smaller than a mountain lion. Sharon Cremosis, a rancher and a friend of mine, insists she saw a large black wildcat slightly smaller than a mountain lion while driving her golf cart on a ranch she owned in a remote area of Boulevard near the border. A neighbor of hers has also seen black wildcats, she told us, and she's also seen mountain lions and is confident in her description. Ariel Brooke, one of our very own writers, who is also a teacher, saw a large black cat running across a roadway in Deerhorn Valley about a year ago. It looked like a black mountain lion and moved like a wild animal, she said, adding it had a long cat-like tail. In 2012, a resident of Aguanga near Warner Springs at the base of Cahuilla Mountain reported she heard her dogs going ballistic and walked outside to see a huge black cat perched on a boulder near her barn, which had a pig, a goat, and horses stabled inside. She said the cat was creeping up the rocks and had glistening circles of gray on its black fur. It was smaller than a mountain lion, and it sounds to us like a black jaguar cub, which can have spots faintly visible. On a blog post, she wrote that neighbors saw the same thing. And the Union Tribune published a report in December 2013 of a couple near Miramar Reservoir who claimed to see a large gray-black cat about 4.5 feet long that swiftly vanished into brush on a steep hill above the water. There have been many sightings locally, though none have been documented with photos, perhaps because these mysterious creatures move swiftly and are often spotted at night. Plus, frightened observers may be more concerned with not becoming dinner than with snapping a photo. We first reported on these mysterious black cat sightings back in 2014, and our readers deluged us with their tales. A reader in the Anza area, in the northeast part of our county, says there were several sightings in 2014 in her area as well. A Pine Valley reader said she was putting out food for a small feral cat in her gazebo one night when she was startled to see what looked like a panther with an unusually strong build, a big head and coal black fur that she believes was a jaguar. I sure froze in my tracks, she told us, adding that she slowly backed up to her door just as the cat dug in its claws into the carpeting on the gazebo she'd been standing on a moment earlier and pulled up the carpet off the cement. On September 1st, that's just last month, Forest Service volunteers Peter and Chris Ruth wrote to warn us that hikers saw a large animal resembling a big black cat in a tree near Cedar Creek Falls in the Julian area, a popular hiking destination. Soon after, two women volunteers hiking the trail to pick up trash heard growling noises three times and promptly exited the area. Were those black jaguars? Or possibly black bears? Another species thought to be extinct here that have since been documented to have returned, though still rare. In 2013, a Border Patrol camera caught proof positive on an infrared camera in Inkapa where a black bear ran across the road. But the big black cat sighting at Cedar Creek Falls becomes more plausible given a second big black cat sighting reported on October 26, just days ago, to our news publication by Cameron Forbes, who says he and his son saw a giant black cat walking past a campground in broad daylight at Pines Anita in the Julian area, the size of a mountain lion or even bigger. These huge black predatory cats have also been seen in Spring Valley. Last year, a retired U.S. Navy chief, Manuel Domingsong, said he heard his chickens making noise and he went out to find a giant black cat inside the coop. It killed a chicken that night, and at 5 a.m. the next morning, he went out to check his coop and found the black cat back inside, and the rest of his chickens were dead. The large cat leaped over a fence right in front of him. 2 months later, a college professor, Dan Moody, told us that his mother, Dee Moody, a retired high school teacher, saw a jet black big cat weighing at least 70 pounds that sauntered across an open field beside her Spring Valley house in broad daylight. She described it as black and shiny, with a tail at least half as long as its body. And then on Christmas Day last year, a retired professor came across two dead coyotes at the end of her cul-de-sac on the eastern side of Dictionary Hill in Spring Valley. Their throats had been slashed, and the bodies were still warm. Only a very large predator, likely a huge cat, could have killed coyotes, which are themselves a predatory species. We do have coyotes across East County, and you may hear their mournful howls at night. But if you're walking out in the dark in East County, and you happen to catch a glimpse of a huge black shadowy cat, or hear the growl of a large animal, remember the sage advice of poet Ogden Nash, who wrote, "When called by a panther, don't anther."
We hope you've enjoyed these haunting tales from East County. We extend our special thanks to the participants in today's special presentation: Miriam Raftery, Leon Thompson, Devario Bell, Tasha Matthews, Liz Alper, and this is Ed Barena. From all of us at East County Magazine and KNSJ Radio, to all of you, our listeners, we wish you a chilling and thrilling Halloween. Happy haunting!
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the mountains to the sea.
Boy Scout Troop 363 in El Cajon needs help after thefts of two trailers containing all of their gear and equipment, including supplies needed to run their annual Christmas tree lot sales in December, a fundraiser that sustains the Scouts year-round camping program, was stolen. In June, the first trailer was stolen out of the Elks parking lot in El Cajon, despite anti-theft measures. They lost all of their camping supplies, but have continued with privately owned camping equipment. But soon after, the troop's Christmas tree lot trailer was also stolen. The boys learn real-life skills working at the tree lot, such as customer service, sales, building the lot, and caring for the trees. Loss of this fundraiser means many boys will not be able to attend future camping events because their families can't afford it. Troop leaders say there is no way for the 35-year-old Troop 363 to continue helping these Scouts on their monthly camping trips without help from the community. Troop leaders hope to raise $10,000 in the next few weeks to buy two Scout trailers, camping gear, and supplies needed for their tree lot so that they can continue to help young people in East County, as well as provide fresh Christmas trees for the community. You can help by donating at a GoFundMe site for Boy Scout Troop 363. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is former Boy Scout Jonathan Goetz.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Goetz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the mountains to the sea.